You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. U.S. labor unions have not historically been part of the pro-peace movement. During the Vietnam War era, when pictures of construction workers in hard hats attacking pro-peace demonstrators appeared in newspapers around the country, the AFL-CIO responded by vigorously supporting the U.S. invasion of Southeast Asia. But as John Hamilton reports, labor's opposition to an Iraq war among overseas workers has been joined by a newfound pro-peace sentiment among many unions here in the U.S. In recognition of Labor Day, Peace Watch re-airs this report by Hamilton that aired a few months ago.
It's hardly an anti-war manifesto, but the AFL-CIO's resolution on the Iraq War is an historic departure for organized labor in the U.S. American trade unions have a long history of backing U.S. military adventures overseas and have lent their support to wars in Vietnam, Afghanistan, and even the first Gulf War. Bob Muhlenkamp helps to coordinate U.S. Labor Against War, a coalition of trade union groups that formed last January to oppose another Gulf War.
It's the first time that the top leadership of the labor movement in the United States has openly challenged the war policy of a president.
It's not only the AFL-CIO that's weighed in on Iraq. Many international unions and local labor bodies are officially on record as opposing the war. The executive boards of the American Postal Workers Union, the Service Employees International Union, the Communications Workers of America, and Unite have all passed resolutions against an attack. So too have AskMe, the United Farm Workers, and the United Electrical and Machine Workers. Only the American Federation of Teachers is on record supporting a U.S. invasion.
In addition, over 200 local unions and 41 central labor councils around the country, including very large cities like Philadelphia, Cleveland, Los Angeles, have come out against the war.
Muhlenkamp says that union bodies representing a third of all organized workers in the U.S. are on record opposing an attack. That's a remarkable turnaround from labor's position in the days following September 11, 2001. That Tuesday morning, UAW Local 2325 President Michael Letwin watched the towers of the World Trade Center crumble from his New York City home. Letwin says he knew immediately that the U.S. would respond with an attack and set off to organize trade unionists against the war.
And the effort that began right after 9/11 with those committees was to try to build labor representation within the anti-war movement and anti-war representation in the labor movement.
But with the AFL-CIO and public opinion overwhelmingly in support of the U.S.'s military campaign in Afghanistan, Letwin faced an uphill battle organizing labor against the war.
But I think what's happened is that with Iraq emerging as the main war issue, a year after 9/11, there's a far greater willingness among many workers and even union officials to take anti-war activities and anti-war positions.
Labor's remarkable turnaround on the war issue was apparent on January 18th, when New Yorkers with SEIU Local 1199 led a march of more than 100,000 anti-war protesters through the streets of Washington, D.C. Brian Morris says he joined thousands of other trade unionists in the streets that weekend to remember the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Well, I don't know if you know, but 1199 is Dr. King's union. It was Dr. King's union, always will be Dr. King's union. Dr. King was against the war. We're out here, the war brings nothing but chaos and confusion. That's why we're out here.
Marie Nelson Fiedler traveled to Washington, D.C. from her home in Minnesota to march that Martin Luther King weekend. Her union, AskMe, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, had recently adopted a resolution condemning an invasion of Iraq.
It's guns and butter, and we're putting too much money into guns and not enough money into butter, which is the social services, the education, the welfare of the people.
That's a position shared by Bill Lucy, head of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists and Secretary Treasurer of AskMe. The 1.3 million strong union represents public employees who've faced layoffs, stalled contracts, and reduced benefits, all as a result of the massive budget shortfalls plaguing most state and local governments.
At least on paper right now, there's about a $60 to $70 billion budget shortfall at state and local government levels, growing as we speak as a result of, you know, our increased responsibilities for homeland security measures. And we think that this issue has to be met head on. And it cannot be met in the context of an escalating defense budget primarily because of the Iraq situation.
Many unions overseas are directly challenging the war effort. Trade unionists are among the leaders of the Turkish anti-war movement. This trade unionist is with Harbor East, literally the War Workers Union, which represents employees of the Turkish defense industry. He warns that even his union stands firmly opposed to an attack.
A parliament which is against the people cannot stand. If this war proceeds, the parliament will change as a whole.
Thanks in part to pressure from Turkish labor unions, that parliament bowed to public opinion and rejected the resolution. But Turkish labor unions plan to keep up the pressure. In Italy, where unions helped to put an estimated 3 million anti-war activists in the streets of Rome last month, the General Confederation of Italian Workers has threatened strikes at the onset of an invasion. Pakistan's unions have threatened mass demonstrations and hunger strikes outside U.S. embassies. And many Australian unions are threatening industrial action to protest Prime Minister John Howard's support for Bush's drive to war.
Well, Australian workers are overwhelmingly opposed to the war.
Sharon Burrows is president of the Australian Council of Trade Unions.
Our Prime Minister has no mandate from the people to seek a war against Iraq, a people with whom we have no fight, and indeed a people whom our Prime Minister talks about as the collateral damage, as if somehow the injuring and maiming of innocent people is acceptable.
And in Britain, Labour opposition to war fueled the largest ever revolt by Labour Party members against Prime Minister Tony Blair. Michael Ricks is General Secretary of ASLEF, the British Train Drivers Union.
I am proud that some train drivers, my ASLEF members, have refused to drive trains with military material for what they and the union regards as an immoral and unjustified war. No British workers have done anything like this for very many years. This war is not in our name.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm John Hamilton of the Workers' Independent News Service.
Former POW Jessica Lynch just signed a $1 million book deal to be entitled I Too Am a Soldier. Lynch came to prominence when her convoy took a wrong turn in Iraq and was ambushed. Although much has been made of her heroism under attack, it was later learned that she never fired her weapon because it jammed. The Pentagon went into the hospital in Iraq where she was recovering with guns blazing, although it was known that all opposition forces had left more than 36 hours before. The number of those wounded in action since the war began in March totals 1,124. That number has grown so large and attacks have become so commonplace that U.S. Central Command usually issues news releases listing injuries only when the attacks kill one or more troops. The result is that many injuries go unreported. Susan Schumann is the mother of Justin, who is currently stationed in Iraq and has been deployed since late March. Peace Watch spoke with Schumann recently about her views of the war and specifically how she deals with the continually mounting death toll.
Emotionally, it's extremely difficult to deal with the daily count and the daily death toll. You just never know. I heard a member of that brigade had been killed in Baghdad, and I felt like a punch in the stomach. The bottom was falling out of my world. I do want to say one thing about this figure of 279 deaths. I think that figure is not very accurate. In fact, it doesn't count the number of non-combat deaths by firearms, which we suspect very much are suicides. It doesn't count the deaths from the mysterious pneumonia virus, or any of those other figures that are not being said on in the media. And I think it's really important that we keep pushing to find out what is the real truth about the actual number of deaths.
Do you have another figure that you feel is closer to accurate?
I don't, and I have been doing some research on the internet trying to find out, and I haven't been able to find out. The same as we were not told the truth before the war started, we're not being told any more truth at this present time either.
And you mentioned suicides. What makes you feel as though they're suicides?
It's something that I have heard from a number of sources. In particular, the Vets for Peace website speaks of this thing about non-combat firearms death.
Mm-hmm. The vague term. Has your son spoken to you about suicides?
No, he has not. Mm-hmm. He has not. And unfortunately, my communications with my son are getting worse and worse. He no longer has regular access to the internet because the roads are too dangerous to travel to the, I think it's about 50 kilometers to where he can get access to the internet.
Mm-hmm.
A question that I would have as a mother is, how can, in this day and age, our soldiers not have access to the internet where they're stationed?
Mm.
I find that very worrisome and very curious.
How often are you able to hear from your son now?
Well, he called me about 1 o'clock in the morning last Sunday morning, and it's been like once every 3 weeks.
Are letters out of the question?
I have not received a letter from him.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, I haven't received very many emails recently.
When he spoke with you last Sunday morning, what did he say? Did he describe the conditions on the ground there?
Well, yes, he did. And he said that it's extremely difficult physically. I think it's a very, very rigorous physical situation. It's 120 degrees. They're rationed to a couple of liters of water per day, which certainly is not very much in that kind of a heat. He hasn't had a square meal since he left on March 29th. He doesn't complain about this. Obviously, he's a soldier, and he does what he needs to do uncomplainably, but from a mother's perspective, I certainly am very concerned. And as a citizen, I don't understand this kind of cheap treatment of American soldiers.
Hmm. Did you support this war, Susan Schuman?
I did not. Very early on, I was very, very concerned about the rhetoric about Iraq. I was very concerned about the evidence that was being presented that trying to justify the invasion of Iraq. I think we've all understood that that evidence was not accurate and that Iraq did not pose a threat to our security. I was also very concerned that the invasion of Iraq had nothing to do with the concern about terrorism in the world. There was very little connection to terrorism, and I see that the administration now seems to mix up their justification for staying in Iraq, saying it's a war on terrorism, when they've created their own terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
I've spent a good many years, about 20 years or so, working in developing nations. I work in education. So I've seen firsthand where terrorism comes from, in the fact that terrorism comes from social injustice.
Mm-hmm.
And our American foreign policy, especially under Bush 1 and Bush 2, has promoted a repressive foreign policy, a regressive profit-promoting foreign policy. And that's the root of terrorism.
And so what about your son, Justin? Clearly, he volunteered to join the service. What was he thinking about this war when he signed up? And what are his thoughts now?
Well, my son is a member of the Massachusetts National Guard. And basically, he joined the Guard so that he could finance his college education, like so many young men and women who are recruited into the military, and especially in the National Guard and the Reserves, in order to get a tuition break at state colleges and universities. I don't think he was thinking that he would be the occupier of a nation. I don't think he was thinking that at all. So that I think one thing that's very important to remember is how these young people were recruited into the military. I think also something very important to point out is that 60 to 70% of the troops are reservists and National Guardsmen.
Mm, that's a pretty high figure.
Yep, that's pretty.
Who are you quoting?
I'm quoting the National Guard Reserves website.
Uh-huh. And so, okay, Justin was of one frame of mind when he entered the National Guard. What are his thoughts about this war now, as he is living in the midst of it on the front lines?
You know, I can't speak for Justin now.
What has he told you? I see where it's reported that he said there are at least 30 to 40 major incidents of violence a day.
Yeah. He essentially describes it as an urban desert guerrilla war, just like what he imagines Vietnam was like. And he said that his unit is often, there are ambushes every day. His office took a direct mortar hit about 4 weeks ago. Fortunately, no one was injured. He said that their vehicle pool looks like something out of World War II. He said every single vehicle has damage from bullets and shrapnel and grenades.
Mm.
I think, you know, I can't speak for Justin because he is not. He's a very loyal soldier. And as you know, soldiers are not permitted to speak their minds politically about what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
He was very, very concerned last Thanksgiving when he had been warned that it was very likely that he would be called to active duty. And one of the things he expressed great concern that it was going to be unwinnable, that it would turn into a guerrilla war in an urban setting.
And so when you speak with him now, he's pretty closed-mouthed about those type of political issues?
Yeah. He just can't say anything.
Earlier,
it doesn't sound like morale is great in his unit.
Why do you say that?
Reading between the lines, it sounds to me as if there are a great many soldiers who are pretty disgruntled and pretty unhappy about the reason they're there. And one of the reasons why morale is so poor where he is, because he has no date for return. They're not saying anything. And it's really, really hard on the soldiers not to know when they're coming back. They were told that they were going to go in as liberators and the streets would be strewn with rose petals like Paris in 1944. And what they found is that, once again, they were lied to and they're like Caesar's armies in the empire building. They're occupying a hostile nation.
If you had an opportunity to speak with President Bush, Ms. Schumann, Bush did address the American Legion's convention. What would you want to personally say to the president?
I would say you must bring the troops home now.
Any final thoughts on your part?
Well, I guess I think the American people really need to begin to wake up and really look at what the truth of this war in Iraq is all about. We're spending $1 billion a week. We're spending the lives of our loved ones. And for what purpose? The purpose is for the financial gain of the Bush oligarchy. And I really think that I would certainly support a move to impeach President Bush and charge Dick Cheney with treason and the murder of American soldiers.
Susan Schumann is the mother of U.S. soldier Justin, stationed in Iraq since March 2003. Tomorrow, we will speak with Mike Lux, who founded the Fair and Balanced PAC. At the center of the PAC's effort is the website www.recallbush.org, where a petition is collecting the names of those wanting a new chief executive in 2004. On the civil liberties front, the American Civil Liberties Union made public today a confidential report showing that facial recognition technology at use in Boston's Logan Airport and two other cities confirms that the technology does not work well enough to be an effective security tool. Police in Tampa, Florida, meanwhile, announced late last month that they were discontinuing the use of facial recognition technology, while authorities in Virginia Beach, Virginia, continue to monitor the city's residents and visitors, maintaining that the system does work. Facial recognition technology is just one of a myriad of new high-tech developments to raise concerns among civil libertarians. Speaking recently at a press conference called by the Trap Rock Peace Center in Western Massachusetts, Mount Holyoke College, Professor Christopher Pyle compared the government's new powers under the Patriot Act to government surveillance during the Vietnam War, and he said we need to put the brakes on domestic spying.
You know about the new apparatus is that it dwarfs anything that J. Edgar Hoover could possibly have imagined. Indeed, it dwarfs anything the Gestapo or the KGB could have imagined because of the magic of computer technology. I'm not suggesting that the spirit behind the new system is the spirit of the KGB or the Gestapo or even J. Edgar Hoover. It's not, at least not at the moment. But it is massive, and it is so because what used to take J. Edgar Hoover's gumshoes weeks of door knocking to collect can now be accessed in a nanosecond with a computer. Sonny has referred to one example, the Total Information Awareness System being developed by former Admiral John Poindexter. You may remember Admiral Poindexter. He was Ronald Reagan's national security advisor. He was the one who sold American weapons to a terrorist nation in order to pick up some profits to support a covert military operation in Nicaragua. Well, despite his criminal record and his convictions, he has been hired by the Pentagon to develop a system of bringing together the results of governmental and commercial data banks to create profiles of suspects and people who might know suspects. And people who might know people who are suspects. And we're all about 6 degrees of removal from other people anyway. So you and I can be on that list. Today there are dozens of agencies, U.S. and foreign, linked together by fiber optic cables for the purposes of sharing information and of necessity misinformation about suspected terrorists and people who might know them. Now, since September 11, the military has returned to domestic surveillance in a big way, but not as in the old days with counterintelligence agents on the street in plain clothes, but now with what is known as data mining. Data mining is the name of the game, and every agency with a computer can play it. The idea is to produce detailed profiles of suspected terrorists. But the capability, once established, can be used whenever the government is concerned about and wishes to silence its critics. Imagine that you're a whistleblower or a journalist or a congressional staffer or an attorney working with the ACLU. You want to investigate and expose the wrongdoing. What are your chances of success today? Before the system cracks down on you. I would say not very good. And under the new Patriot Act, the government can quickly gain access to your email, perhaps through John Poindexter's operation at the Pentagon. Under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, as amended by the Patriot Act, government agents can easily get what I call a pseudo-warrant to tap your phone or bug your home, and they get it not from a regular court, but from a secret foreign intelligence surveillance court whose members are appointed by William H. Rehnquist. What they would do is go into court and say, we have a suspected terrorist. We want to tap his phone, and we want authority also to tap any phone he might use. That means that if the government wants to tap a journalist, it has a technique of doing it that it could use without having to tell a judge it planned to tap a journalist or a congressional staffer or an attorney. That's serious. It was reasonable to worry about burglaries back then, because we later discovered, when I worked for the Church Committee, that the government had conducted hundreds of burglaries. They called them black bag jobs. Today, the government would not have to conduct an illegal burglary, because under the Patriot Act, it can conduct what are called sneak and peek searches under those pseudo-warrants issued by the secret court. And the government doesn't have to leave a copy of the warrant behind or an inventory of the things taken. So when you get home and find your laptop is missing, you have no idea who came in and stole your laptop. And the only way you would find out about it is if the government were to use evidence from your laptop in a prosecution, which it is unlikely to be foolish enough to do. As you know, the Bush administration believes that the president's war power, and they claim we're in a war, The president's war power enables him to make people disappear by the simple expedient of labeling them enemy combatants. Under the Patriot II Act, which the Bush administration is certain to submit to Congress when the next terrorist attack occurs, so it can stampede it through swiftly, the government would be authorized to arrest people in secret and not reveal that it even has them in detention. Well, let's suppose you don't get arrested. Only your sources are seized and spirited away in the night. The Bush administration won't tell you where they are. The federal prison system won't tell you where they are. So you go to a congressional committee, and it makes the inquiry. Is it likely to be successful? They haven't been so far. But let's say you persist, and the government really is upset about what you're doing. It may claim that you're associated somehow with your sources, who may be associated with terrorists. If so, it can convene a grand jury, haul you before the grand jury, and demand that you disclose their identities. It'll give you immunity from prosecution for any self-incriminating statements, in return for you incriminating everybody else, and give you the choice, if you don't like that, of going to jail, at least for the duration of the grand jury. But under the Patriot Act, the government really does not have to bludgeon you with a grand jury proceeding. It can arrest you and hold you, as the Bush administration has, for over a month as an alleged material witness to somebody else's crimes. Doesn't have to charge you. It locks you away because you're a witness and you might flee. And the government is even creating a new form of Homeland Security information that, while not classified information, will get you in trouble if you disclose it. Even if your purpose of disclosing it is to inform the Congress of the United States or the courts of the United States that illegal activity is going on. Today, we have a domestic intelligence bureaucracy that can do a lot of harm to those who challenge its legitimacy or its usefulness. Our capacity to subject that system to oversight, either by Congress or the press or by litigation, is very weak. Our capacity to bring it to heel is weak as well, especially so long as both houses of Congress and the White House are controlled by the same political party. And that would be the case if the Democrats were in power. It wouldn't make a lot of difference. Now, I'd like to be able to say that we're in this predicament because bad people have taken over. But that's really inaccurate. The fact is, this is a very democratic system. The intelligence apparatus I've described is supported by an inattentive public and docile members of Congress who unwisely assume that this apparatus will only be used against those other people. And while we'll defend our own rights to the death, for convenience and safety's sake, we're more than willing to give up somebody else's rights, not seeing the connection. We need to correct that misperception, and that's what the conference on the 25th and the 26th is about. And I hope you'll all come and attend. Thank you very much.
Christopher Pyle is a professor at Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts. He spoke at a press conference for the Trap Rock Peace Center. You can visit the center's website at traprockpeace.org. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Luna Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons, taking the train to Tibet. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Otto Hammett of KPFA, Fidel Rodriguez of KPFK, Matt Bradley and Sam Husseini. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Alex Mitchell at WebActive.com for web help. It's your financial support that makes Peace Watch possible, so we urge you to make a generous donation through our secure online website. website at pacifica.org, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. Special thanks to Ross Porzal, Mohammed Owais, Andy Shalal, Fahima Sek, and A.C. Bird. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send your feedback to us at peacewatch@pacifica.org. You can also visit webactive.com to listen to archives of past Peace Watch programs. To get a copy of this show, call the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.